Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Teresa Roth. She is the executive director of the New York State Children's Alliance, or NISCA. It's a nonprofit, membership-based organization. She joined the organization in February 2024 and has dedicated her career to advocating for victims of sexual violence and child abuse, and has worked in the field of victim advocacy for over 20 years. You can find out more about the organization at NISCA, N-Y-S-C-A, at www.nyschildrensalliance.org. Welcome, Teresa Roth.
I'm so glad to be here.
Well, this is a tough one. And before we get into some of the specifics, how did you end up getting to be the executive director of NISCA? And maybe just a little more about the Alliance's mission.
Okay, so for just about my entire career, I've worked in the field of victim advocacy. I started with the Rape Crisis Program, which is called Restore Sexual Assault Services in Genesee County. When I was just beginning my career. So I've worked in the field of sexual violence for a very long time, and that role afforded me the opportunity to work with the Child Advocacy Center and the multidisciplinary team, which is a very important part of the Child Advocacy Center movement, is that the work is very collaborative. So even as an outside organization, I got to work very closely with the Child Advocacy Center and really developed a lot of respect and admiration both for the approach and for the professionals working within that field. And during my time working with Restore, I worked with a lot of adults who had been sexually abused as children. And what was very notable to me was that years, decades down the line, one of the things that a lot of adult survivors struggle with is that initial response to when they disclose as a child that someone was harming them. And in most cases, statistically speaking, it's almost always someone that the child knows, loves, and trusts. So my work with adult survivors really has both informed my work in the child advocacy realm and fueled my passion for supporting a response that gets it right. So that when a kiddo that comes through a child advocacy center today is in their 30s or 40s, in spite of anything else that they may be struggling with still or was struggling with at that time, my mission is to make sure that any child who comes to a child advocacy center will feel heard, believed, and supported. So that's what's really driven me to get into child advocacy center world. So after working with Restore for many years, I transferred over to work at the Justice for Children Advocacy Center, which obviously made me even more, frankly, in love with the work. I think that it's brilliant the way that all of these diverse agencies and professionals can come together for the best interest of children. And while that diversity of thought and profession and responsibility can make the work challenging sometimes, I'm sure as you can imagine, the educational background, the role, the personal worldview can differ from one discipline to another. I mean, if you know a social worker, they are probably very different than somebody who is in law enforcement. But that's what makes the model so effective, because it empowers all of these people with all these expertise to come together for a mission that is easy for everyone to agree on, which is the safety and recovery of a child who's been abused. So working for a child advocacy center really enforced my devotion to the work of child advocacy centers. And when the opportunity to join NISCA arose, I was really interested in it. The idea of being able to support child advocacy centers statewide really appealed to me. And, you know, just a few months in, I can say that I feel like I made the right decision and I'm really enjoying my job.
That's great. It's incredible work the more I read about it. And I guess that's the thing. People, including myself, who is tasked to be informed on everything possible, wasn't as informed as I should be. And what prompted me to reach out to you, we're speaking with Teresa Roth, Executive Director of the New York State Children's Alliance, is an article I read in the Albany Times Union. And here's the headline. This will put a face on the issue for many. New York had hundreds of confirmed abuse cases in public schools last year. A kindergarten teacher in Brooklyn made her students carry a bin of blocks up and down stairs as punishment. A high school math teacher in a Buffalo suburb used a wooden meter stick to hit female students on their legs. A teacher's aide in a school near Ithaca pulled a child's hair so they would, quote, know what it felt like. In other places, public school educators engaged in sexually explicit conversations with students, verbally disparaged them, held them in excessive restraints, pushed, punched, slapped, and spanked them. Now, this is the part that I think the next line that captures what most of us probably think and don't realize. Corporal punishment and child abuse are illegal in New York, and it was made explicit in a new law signed by Governor Kathy Hochul in October that rules also apply to all schools. But I think most people think, well, corporal punishment was outlawed, so that can't be happening in the state schools, but that's happening in more. And you're in this article as well, quoting just what your organization does, this holistic approach to trying to help young people.
Yes. You know, obviously, any type of child abuse is unacceptable, to be perfectly frank. But when you think of it happening within the context of a school, you know, statistically speaking, 1 in 10 children is sexually abused before they graduate high school. And even more children are exposed to physical abuse or violence in the home or neglect. So, you know, on top of my concern about abuse being perpetrated in school, I'm very concerned about the fact that you have these children who, as I said earlier, unfortunately are victimized most likely by somebody that they know, love, and trust, not even being able to feel safe in school, which for a lot of kids, unfortunately, is the only place they could feel safe. So, you know, as I said, it's alarming that this happens in school, but especially disappointing because this school should be a safe place for children, especially those who don't feel safe at home.
Well, let's bring in the mandated reporter part of this, because employees of the school, the public schools, all schools now, I guess, are mandated reporters. If they see symptoms of child abuse or suspect child abuse, they need to report it. And in the article, it pointed out that many of the schools that may have problems often are the ones that don't report a lot. Their numbers are way down, and that's what raises suspicion, not the schools that seem to be reporting what would be average numbers, I guess.
Yes. And, you know, it's very difficult. I alluded to it in the article, to know for sure whether a school with low reports have low reports because they're doing a very good job of ensuring the safety of their students, or if, you know, unfortunately, there's a reluctance to make a report. And, you know, in that case, a school with a low rate of incidents could indicate a school that's not reporting as they should be. And that's very concerning. In addition to the fact that, you know, children who are at risk of any kind of abuse are often at risk of all kinds of abuse. So, you know, children at higher risk of abuse, for example, who have a disability or a mental health diagnosis, not only are they higher risk for being abused outside of school, they're a higher risk for being abused inside of school. So unfortunately, the kiddos that don't have a good support system at home might not even be able to come home and say, you know, my teacher did this and it hurt me or it scared me, which is kind of a compounding issue where, you know, I'm envisioning children I worked with over the years that really have no safe haven. And in the absence of schools taking a trauma-informed approach to children's behavior, one victimization could increased vulnerability to another victimization. So, for example, if you've got a young elementary school child who is being abused at home and is concerned about the safety of a younger sibling at home when they're away at school, I have seen situations where that child acts out at school knowing that that's their ticket to get home so they can keep an eye on the safety of their younger sibling.
Oh, my.
And that's heartbreaking to understand that, you know, in that case, that's the foundation of the behavior. It's not defiance. It's not, you know, an unwillingness to learn. It's not a dislike for school or their teacher. This poor little child is in a situation where they feel an obligation to protect a younger sibling and know that certain behaviors are going to get them removed from school for the day. So I think it's really important that schools take a trauma-informed approach to children's behaviors, not in a way that excludes a child from consequences, because obviously you need to maintain order for the safety of other children and staff and for a productive learning environment. But, you know, if the approach first is to ask, you know, what happened to this child before asking what's wrong with this child, that sets us a very good foundation for really being able to meet children where they're at and to meet their needs and provide them, you know, structure and sometimes consequences in a way that are going to be productive and are less likely to create further harm.
Yeah, and that's really the issue. You don't want them telling their story over and over again based on the different folks mm-hmm. they have to see. And that's where these child advocacy centers come in. Can you go in a little more detail, though? Give us an idea, because I know that one of the things that we often hear, especially with adult rape victims, is you don't want to re-traumatize them.
Exactly. Yes. The goal is to interview a child as little as possible. And in most cases, through child advocacy centers, it's a single interview. So before child advocacy centers existed, you know, even very well-trained, engaged, professional responders to child abuse were stuck working in silos. There wasn't a way for them to really work together. So that resulted in a situation where a child, for example, would disclose to their teacher, and then their principal would want to hear from them. And then, you know, ideally, the child abuse hotline would be called, and then a caseworker would interview the child. And then at some point, a law enforcement professional would interview the child. And this could happen anywhere. This could happen at the school. It could happen at the kitchen table with the person that harmed the child lurking in another room. It could even happen in the bedroom when the abuse occurred. And even after all of that, you know, then the child and family may have to seek medical treatment someplace else or talk to a counselor someplace else, not have a lot of support and guidance through all that process, during which the family is under a tremendous amount of stress, as you can imagine. So what child advocacy centers do is bring all of those professionals to the child and family in one place that is child-focused. So a lot of child advocacy centers throughout the state, if you were sitting in one of their waiting rooms, it could be indistinguishable from a living room or a playroom. The focus is making the child and family feel as comfortable as possible with everybody there working together for that child. So at child advocacy centers, like I said, you know, we strive for a single interview, and the interview is conducted by somebody who is trained specifically to do those interviews. And, you know, having been in the field, I can say forensic interviewing a child is both a science and an art. The models that are approved by the state are evidence-based and constantly being researched and re-researched because of the importance of getting it right, not only in terms of, you know, obviously obtaining information necessary to prosecute a crime, but speaking with a child in a way that is not suggestive or leading, which, you know, again, is an art and a science, because you want to make sure that, you know, the child doesn't feel that they need to say things just to please the interviewer. And, you know, since my background is in victim advocacy, most importantly to me personally is that the interview doesn't re-traumatize the child, that the child feels that they're not being forced to do something. Because the reason that they're there to see us is because they're forced to do something. So the approach that child advocacy centers takes kind of checks all those boxes. And so during the interview, it's just the interviewer and the child in one room, and the interview is observed by other professionals involved in the investigation. So at most child advocacy centers, it's child protection and law enforcement. Some involve prosecutors or county attorneys. And the importance of that is that everybody gets a chance to observe what is going on in real time. And in most cases, before the forensic interviewer wraps up the interview completely, they'll step out for a moment, check in with the team, see if there are any matters that need clarification or information that needs to be gathered. And then the interviewer will go in and revisit those topics. And that right there is at the heart of how we're able to reduce the number of interviews, that you've got everybody there. You know, a child protection worker is going to need different information than a law enforcement officer or a prosecutor. So everyone's there to make sure that they get the information that they need in one shot. So throughout that process, the importance of the family that the child will be going home to cannot be overstated. So the family members, the non-offending caregivers, are connected with an advocate who can help to keep families informed of the progress of the case. They can link families with services that they might have needed prior to victimization or because of. So, for example, if the abuser was a breadwinner in the home and has to be removed, then a family could find themselves in crisis, not just because of the abuse, but financially because of the loss of that income to the family. So advocates can help with that, and advocates can serve as a voice for the child and family when working with the members of the multidisciplinary team. Another service that's available through child advocacy centers is medical exams. They're conducted by medical professionals specially trained in the field of child abuse. A lot of CACs have those exam rooms right on site. Some of them have linkage agreements with local hospitals or clinics. And the exam has several purposes. As you can imagine, if there are injuries that exist, we want to identify and treat them. From a prosecution standpoint, we obviously want to document them if they exist. But in the majority of cases, even when an instance of abuse is substantiated in other ways, there are not physical findings. So one of the most important aspects of the physical exam is the child's emotional well-being. So, you know, most children have an established relationship of trust with a doctor and respect for medical professionals. So for a child to go in and hear from the doctor that everything is okay, they are healthy, no one can tell by looking at them that something happened. In cases where the child was abused by somebody, say, of the same gender, a medical professional can ask questions about what that means to the child in terms of their own sexuality. So the medical exam, which is non-invasive, it can be very helpful emotionally for the child to get that reassurance. And then as the case moves forward, the team works together with prosecution and maintains regular communication. So the team members meet on a regular basis to review cases, to, you know, strategize, keep each other up to date, and work together for the best interests of the children.
Wow, we're running out of time quickly. We're speaking with Teresa Roth, Executive Director of the New York State Children's Alliance. And the advocacy centers that she talked about, you can find out where those are by just going to their website, nyschildrensalliance.org. All that information is there, and it's very helpful. Now, I want to get to sort of the heart of the issue when it comes to New York State government and politics, and that's legislative action. And I know you're certainly watching the legislature. We just mentioned the expansion of the law to all schools in New York signed in October by Governor Hochul, but also the actual definition of abuse. What does it include? It's a large definition, and one of the things that's in that definition is hunger. And we're really having a problem right now. Many schools are in meal debt, and the system, according to many who I've spoken to when it comes to food in schools, is broken. So that is kind of on the state to fund, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I think especially for children, basic nutrition should be a basic human right. You know, we live in the wealthiest country in the world, and to provide food for children is something I think that we as a culture have a moral obligation to do.
Yeah, and the leadership that I'm sure your organization lobbies and the folks around the state who represent the districts, which are all of them, where children are, what's their reaction? I mean, why don't we see more? Is it because children don't come to the Capitol lobby a lot? What is it? Why wouldn't we do better by the children? Is it because we condemn the adults?
So I think that when it comes to child welfare in general, one of the biggest hurdles is that most people cannot conceive of some of the conditions that children have to exist in, you know?
Yeah, I can, and forgive me for interrupting, Teresa, but I can hear people going, how in the hell can people who would do that to children end up in a school? What's wrong with their hiring practices? But it's not that simple, mm-hmm. is it?
It's not. It really isn't. And one of the things I talk about all the time in community education is that if people looked like the kind of person that could harm a child, they would never have access to children to create that harm. You know, you can't tell right. by looking at people that they would harm a child. Some people who are, you know, very prominent or who are involved in community organizations and who frankly do good things in other aspects of their life are also capable of hurting kids.
Yeah. And, you know, while background checks are important, if it's not in the resume or if people are afraid to report it to damage the reputation of the previous school, you're left in a weird situation.
Yeah. And I think the most important way to combat that is to make sure that children and adults are aware of the warning signs of abuse. So if we have a school community where all the grown-ups know the rules when it comes to interacting with children and know the warning signs that their colleagues are breaking the rules, that empowers that community to respond appropriately to warning signs. And if the children in that school community are educated to know, you know, what rules the grown-ups have to follow in terms of the way they engage with kids, and are given a trustworthy and reliable pathway to speaking with a safe adult about their concerns, that is another way to fortify the safety of children, both in the school and outside of the school, for them to know that it's grown-up's job to keep kids safe. And if a grown-up is dropping the ball on that, you keep telling grown-ups until one of them does their job.
Well, does it matter who the next president is to children in terms of the impact and the policies that might be in place to help them?
Honestly, you know, I don't know. I mean, I clearly would not endorse one candidate over another in my role. I think that when we're talking about public policy related to the safety and well-being of children, unlike other topics or other areas of concern, when you're advocating for child safety and welfare, you have a little bit of a leg up in terms of the fact that nobody you talk to is going to say, I'm not really all that interested in the well-being of kids. Right. Everyone will say that they are. And I think that people, while invested in the safety of kids, have different opinions about how to get there. So, you know, again, I think we come back to the realm of education and helping our policymakers to understand what works and what doesn't work. I mean, the child welfare field, especially related to child advocacy centers, is relatively new in terms of social movements and things like that. But there's a lot of data and there's a lot of studies and, you know, we have approaches and models that we know are effective. And I think it's a matter of having policymakers come on board to, you know, draft legislation that supports the work and certainly offers up funding for the agencies that respond. In New York State alone, there hasn't been an increase in funding directly for child advocacy centers since 2017. And as you can imagine, costs have increased just for every center. And thankfully, the number of child advocacy centers has grown in New York State. At this point, we're up to 46, covering 61 counties in the state. So we have more centers, we have more cases. And in the climate that we're in, with increased mental health issues, increased substance use issues, problems with the economy, all of those factors can contribute to the children that come in having even more needs than they would previously have. So the need has increased and the funding has not.
All right. Well, here's a personal question for you and your colleagues. Talk about mental health issues. How do you go home at night and separate yourself from some of the horrific things you must have seen throughout your career? I mean, I can't even imagine having to sit in a room and deal with a situation like this. My anger would be through the roof.
Yeah, it's complicated, you know, and it certainly leads to a turnover in the field. I'm not going to say I'm a unicorn, but I don't have a lot of colleagues that have been working in the field as long as I have. So everyone has a different way of managing. I can say for myself, the multidisciplinary team model, as good and effective as it is for children and the prosecution of people who harm children, it can be very effective in terms of the team members coping with the work. So over the years, I have found tremendous support from my colleagues in all the different disciplines that I work with combating child abuse. So that's one important thing. And another important thing, at least in the child advocacy center realm, is the fact that the relationship with the children and family is often a long-term one. So you, for example, you know, you see a family on the worst day of their life and months go by and a child is coming for counseling at your child advocacy center. And you begin to see that healing process. And that is very fortifying for the hard days. It kind of gives you a reminder of why you're doing this and some assurance that your work is impacting kids and that kids have the capacity to recover from this.
I'm sorry to say we are out of time. We have been speaking with Teresa Roth, Executive Director of the New York State Children's Alliance. You can find out more at nyschildrensalliance.org. Teresa, thank you for all this incredible work you're doing. And I hope at some point as we go through another legislative session, we can come back and hear from you again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you giving me the chance to elevate child advocacy centers in New York State.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustino.
Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.